We talked about earlier on the nature of apocalyptic writing, which is what the book of Revelation is. Apocalypse mean revelation or an uncovering or disclosure. That's the definition of it. It is a type of writing in which the theme is developed by use of symbols and visions. You have to remember that you cannot take the symbolism that is used in there literally. If you do, you are not going to come out with the right interpretation. You've got to understand the nature of the symbolism there. It is not intended to be literal. Okay? We talked about the symbolism of numbers, and I passed out a handout. And if anybody did not get one of those, you still need one, and see me afterwards. I think I've only got one copy left, but I can make more if we need more. So they're like Doritos, all right? Okay, so as we talked about the symbolism of numbers, one of the things that we concluded about this, and we've got to keep in mind as we go through our study, from this observation of the symbolic use of numbers, it follows that the real numbers which occur in Revelation, remember this, cannot be understood with real numeric value. Alright? They cannot even be considered as round numbers. They are not intended to be so. They are just symbolic. Okay? And that's where you go back to your page that we talked about, went through each one of the different numbers and what they mean and what they represent, what the symbolism is about, that to help you get a better idea of what it's really trying to tell you. Okay, but just so wipe out, as you're looking at Revelation, wipe out of your mind true numerical values, okay? Just wipe that out of there, okay? They're purely symbolical, and we must discard our mathematical ideas and seek to discover their symbolical significance. In other words, one of the problems that we so often run into when people are trying to understand Revelation is they take the numbers literally, and they start kind of adding and subtracting and multiplying and dividing and adding this and that and so forth, and coming up with all these reasons why this particular person or this particular event is what this is talking about. When you start doing that, you're going to run into all kinds of problems in proper understanding, okay? Much of the interpretation of prophecy is based on the false view of the value of numbers used by the writer. Okay, so I'm just saying, just take that, the value of those numbers out and just forget about it. Okay, we began last week talking about theories of interpretation. Basically, the idea here is that if you want to get a proper understanding of the book of Revelation, then you've got to be careful about how you're interpreting it in generally. And there are several theories that are being used at the present time for people to come to an understanding of Revelation. There are some that are not very good theories at all. And there are some, and those theories basically don't give a very good interpretation of what Revelation is all about. And we talked about some last time about those theories that talk about how Revelation is something that we're still waiting to have completely fulfilled or to have it fulfilled. It's all about the future. Then there's those that talk about how Revelation has already been fulfilled. It was already done way, way back before AD 70. All kinds of different theories. We looked at these different theories, and basically we come down to this one, where we left off last week, the historical background prophetic principle method. Okay? That is basically the theory that we're focusing on in this study. All right? As we looked at this, a couple of principles to keep in mind. Okay? This method keeps in mind that the writer wrote his message primarily for the encouragement and edification of Christians of his own time. Right? That addresses one of the objections that were to some of the other ones that, say if you're talking about Revelation only being for those who are around when the Lord comes back again, then what relevance did it have for those of his original audience? This focuses on the idea that says, look, John wrote this primarily for those Christians who were living at the time when he wrote it. Okay? Then you ask, okay, so what does that have to do with us today? Why is it valuable to us? Well, one must make a close study of the church of that day, the writer, the conditions from which he wrote, etc., then make application to his own day. So that's what we're going to do this morning, is we're going to go back and look at the conditions that existed then, and then try to see, okay, well, how does that fit into to our world today? It keeps in mind that this book is written largely in symbolical language, as we've been saying all along, where one must ask two questions, okay? First is, what is the picture that's being painted? And secondly, what does it mean? So as we're looking at different things, that's the thing I want to encourage you to do, is to ask those two questions. What's the picture that's painted here, and what does that picture mean? Okay? When an event or person is found to which the prophecy is fairly applicable, it is considered fulfilled in such an event or person, remember I told you last week, but not thereby exhausted. Okay? So in other words, we look at things and say, yeah, this is probably fulfilled at this particular time in history. Okay? But that doesn't mean it is totally exhausted. In other words, we understand that with prophecy, oftentimes, they have a dual application of prophecy. So in other words, prophecy may have an application to something in its immediate time frame. Again, go back to what we see in John in Revelation 1:1. These things were revealed as to what would soon take place, he said. Okay, so some of those things are fulfilled right there, but then is there another application in the future for it? Okay, so it is fulfilled, perhaps, but not exhausted. And you find that with a lot of different prophecies that we read about throughout the Scriptures, okay? It is intended more for the purpose of showing us the forces for good and evil that make history than for the prediction of particular events. This is probably the place where most people run into problems with understanding Revelation. They're using it for the wrong purpose. Okay? People tend to want to use the book of Revelation to try to predict the future events, especially the second coming of Christ. In other words, here's all the signs. This happened, this happened, this happened, so this is getting ready to happen. Using it to predict what's going to happen, rather than understanding it based on the theme that we started with as we began this whole thing, which is what? What's the central theme of the book of Revelation?
Bad.
Okay, things are bad. They're going to get worse. Do what? But victory is assured in the end, right? You keep that theme in mind, right? Then, again, you come to questions like, so what difference does it make when he comes back again? Why do I have to be so concerned about trying to predict and to see, you know, oh, this happened, this happened, this happened, so this means this is getting ready to happen. Why don't you be concerned about that? Why not be focused on the fact that, yes, there's a lot of bad things that go on in the world because the world is evil. But we have a God who is in charge of the world. And he has assured us that victory it will be in the end. Okay? So we need to look at it in that particular way. That's the forces of good and evil are there, and that's been and will continue throughout history. All right? So don't look at it as an opportunity to predict particular events. Okay, now that brings us to the historical background of Revelation. All right? Again, we want to be able to look at and try to understand and focus on what was taking place when the book of Revelation was written. When its original audience received this information, what was going on in their world? Okay? And then, as we look at that and understand that more clearly, then how does that kind of fit into our world today? That then makes the book of Revelation relevant to us today in our world. Otherwise, what we're doing is looking at a historical document that's interesting to read, but has really no value to us at all. So let's take some time and look at some things that have to do with the historical background. In other words, what was going on in their world when John wrote this revelation? We're going to look, first of all, at the recipients themselves, okay? And I'm going to read several things. I don't have a lot of this these things on the overhead for you, so I'm just going to share some different things with you, reading to you. So bear with me about that, okay? We're talking about the recipients. The condition of the Christians who first received this writing was very critical. Christianity had remained for several decades unnoticed by the Roman government. Okay? They were just kind of there. Roman government didn't have a whole lot of interest in them, as far as Christians and so forth, at first. The reason is because it had been regarded primarily as part of the Jewish religion, which was a legal religion at the time, as far as the Roman government was concerned. So in other words, the Roman government looked at Christianity basically as kind of being an offshoot of Judaism. And since Judaism was a legal religion, the government really wasn't that concerned in terms of, you know, going and trying to squash this new religion. Now, historically, why do you suppose that was so? Why wouldn't the Roman government be concerned about this new religion? Or this offshoot of Judaism, as they call it? Okay. Primarily, it doesn't upset the government, and you're not interfering with anything we're doing, we're fine. And the policy, and this was not only of the Romans, but many of the cultures, you know, that became world powers as they went and conquered, you know, other nations, other peoples, and so forth. They embraced the religious ideas and so forth of the cultures that they absorbed into their own. And so basically it was like, yeah, you're now a part of the Assyrian Empire, but as long as you don't interfere with us, you know, hey, then do your thing.
And pay your taxes.
And pay your taxes. Because you have to understand the mindset of most of these cultures at the time was that, you know, religion was kind of a, you know, there's all kinds of it out there, and whatever floats your boat is okay. In other words, they recognized that there were multiple religions and everybody had their own thing, and so they didn't get a whole lot bothered by the fact that hey, there's this new religion or what have you that they encountered. They just kind of allowed it to be absorbed into their culture. Okay, Dale?
That's why I think that there are so many admonitions in scriptures to obey your ruling authorities so that you wouldn't be seen as a problem.
Exactly.
Pay your taxes, follow the rules, unless it conflicts with God's laws, then they don't have a reason to be upset.
Yeah, they're going to leave you alone. Okay? Leave you alone, do your thing. Okay? Now, when it became known that Christianity was not just a new patch on the old garment of Judaism, the Christians found themselves in difficulty with the government as well as with their fellow men. Okay, so as Christianity was developing, people started realizing, Jews started realizing, hey, wait a minute here, if you go through the New Testament, you look at Paul's dealings with the Jews, okay, the problems that he had in dealing with Jewish Christians and non-Jewish, Christian Jews, they started saying, wait a minute, this is not what we want, this is not right, this is, you know, an apostasy from Judaism, this stuff's got to be stopped. So there began this, you know, stirring up of problems amongst the Jews with Christians. So the Roman government starts seeing, wait a minute here, the Jews are attacking Christians, why would they be doing that if they're part of the same group? So there starts to be this problem that develops. Now, what happens as a result of this is that there becomes more and more antagonism on the part of the government especially towards Christianity. All right, now the Jews are already not liking Christians, okay? But now you have a government that starts getting involved because of different things that are going on, okay? So, for instance, Christianity was, first of all, as it became known that it was not a part of Judaism, Christianity suddenly was an illegal religion, as far as the Roman government was concerned, okay? Rome tolerated the religion of those whom they conquered so long as they did not proselyte. Okay? Christians, of course, existed to do what? Exactly. So, in other words, you know, the Roman attitude towards religion was, you know, do your own thing, just keep to yourself, don't go around trying to, you know, put pressure on anybody else and so forth. Well, again, you know, the Jews were pretty content with that idea, weren't they? You know, they were content, as I think Judy said earlier, you know, hey, you know, we've got God, you know, we're the true religion, we're the true ones of God, and, you know, if you want him, then you come to us, otherwise we're just going to leave you alone. We don't like pagans, we don't like Gentiles, just stay away from us, leave us alone, we'll leave you alone, kind of an attitude. Well, that was not the approach of Christianity at all. Okay, Denise mentioned a moment ago, the Great Commission was what?
Go out.
Go into all the world, right? And do what? Make disciples. Okay? That was the commission, which went against the grain of the Roman government. You leave everybody else alone. Okay? So they began, that is kind of one of the things that really started it. Another thing was that Christianity aspired to universality. With the Romans, the state was the main thing. With the Christians, the kingdom of God throughout the world was the principal concern. Okay? In other words, the Roman government viewed itself as we're the main thing. Okay? We are Rome. Okay? And everybody has to give their allegiance to Rome. And the emperor is a god. And so, if you give your allegiance to Rome, that means you give your allegiance to the emperor. Now, problematic for Christians? Absolutely so. Another part of this was that Christianity was an exclusive religion. Okay? In other words, Christians refused to mingle freely with heathen social life and customs. It did not fit with the Christian lifestyle. Okay? It was necessary for them to refuse intercourse with the pagan world because of the idolatrous practices in which the Romans engaged. In other words, you know, look, we're not participating in these things. You guys are worshiping all these different gods. You're doing all, have all these different, you know, deities and statues and all this stuff. It's paganism. And we cannot and will not participate in any of this. Okay? You see how these things, as they develop, are building up to a confrontation with the Roman Empire as far as its government is concerned. Okay? And then Christians were accused of all manner of evil. Because they held meetings at night and were fond of each other, the Romans figured the meetings were for the gratification of lust. When they heard Christians speak of eating flesh and drinking blood, they accused them of cannibalism. Okay? Those kinds of things. Wait a minute, what is going on with these people? We don't understand this, we don't like it, and therefore we have to get rid of it or stop it. Right? Christians refused to go to war. Okay? Two primary reasons why they refused to go to war. Part of the oath and initiation of the soldiers included service to the idols of the state and the wearing of idolatrous insignia on their uniforms. So Christians said, you know, hey, I can't serve in the military because if I do, I have to take an oath, you know, to serve these idols. The second was that Christ had taken their sword from them and had given them the ways of peace. That is a quote from the early church fathers about their observations at that particular time. Christians were recruited chiefly from the poor and outcasts. And that caused the respectable folks to look down upon Christians. Okay? In the early times, that's where Christians were mainly coming from, was from the class of poor. The slaves and so forth, all right? Christians shared with the Jews the contempt which the Romans held for this people. Because of their refusal to compromise, they were regarded as worse than the Jews. Okay? The Jews had pretty well compromised everything as far as the Roman government was concerned. You go back and you look at the gospel accounts, and especially towards the end of the gospels, you know, in all of the, the backslapping and so forth between the Jewish religious leaders, the high priests and so forth, and the Roman government that was there. The interaction between Caiaphas and Pilate, for instance, and all the stuff that's going on, basically, you know, they kind of like, you know, let's just get along with one another. The Jews had compromised an awful lot in order to get along with and have peace with their Roman occupiers. Okay? Christians, again, because they didn't want to worship idols, they didn't want to participate in any of this stuff, Christians were going, not going to compromise my beliefs. And so again, looked down upon by the Romans. Christians were looked upon as wild fanatics because of their enthusiasm. And Christianity came in conflict with the temporal interests of many of the Romans. The priests, the makers and vendors of sacrificial symbols and signs and statues and so forth. You know, we see one account in the book of Acts where we have the silversmiths that are making all the idols and so forth, and Paul comes in there and he heals this girl, and what happens? They lose their business, and all of a sudden the city's in an uproar. Okay? And part of that is, look, you're not supposed to be worshiping these idols to begin with. Well, wait a minute, who are you to tell us not to be worshiping idols? Oh, you're Christians! Okay, so that kind of stuff was happening. And then also, finally mentioned earlier, Christians refused to worship the emperor. Okay, so we find this is basically where this antagonism builds over some time against Christians by Rome and by the Roman government and so forth. All right. Okay, let's talk about the conditions of the Roman Empire. Okay? As Revelation was being written, okay, the time in history when this was all occurring, Rome was reaching her greatness. All right? In other words, she's kind of at the peak of the empire. All right? The boundaries extended from the British Isles to the African desert and from the Atlantic Ocean to the Euphrates. To the people of that day, it seemed that Rome was the world. Anywhere you went, you know, Rome was there. Rome was the power. All right? The things that made such a great empire possible was large and well-trained armies. The distant frontier saw garrisons of soldiers schooled in the discipline of Roman army life. The fear of the Roman legions went before. They seemed invincible. They brought the wealth and luxury into the city of Rome. In contrast to this wealth and extravagance, there was much dire poverty. There was no work for hire. Right? Why do you suppose that is? That's
slaves.
Yeah, slaves did all the hard labor. Why would you go out and hire someone and pay them a daily wage when you own slaves? You see, so, you know, there's not a lot of jobs available for people. The slaves did that kind of work. So the idle poor swarmed to the capital and to the major cities to be fed by the enormous dole system and to be amused by the many interesting things of city life. Okay? So there's just a lot of, there's basically Rome is it. And you were either a somebody or you were a nobody in terms of the Roman Empire. Okay? Where did Christians mostly fall?
Nobody's.
Okay? Nobody's. All right? Let's talk about the moral conditions that existed. Okay? Teachers of the day were inconsistent. They taught purity and lived immorally. Seneca taught contempt for material wealth, yet amassed over, at that, I'm understanding this is a figure that would be equivalent at that time, over $12 million in a few years. Pupils were like their teachers in their living. According to their own testimony, the Roman caste system, the Romans cast away everything that was good and honorable. Crimes were multiplied, vice made no attempt to hide itself. A monstrous contest of lust and wickedness was carried on. Marriage came to be a commercial transaction, easily effected and as easily dissolved. Children were a burden, and they were left to the slaves for rearing or were sold as slaves themselves. Naturally, the Christians looked with abhorrence upon such conditions. They saw their religion about to be crushed by such a system and wondered about the outcome of it. Revelation was badly needed to assure them of victory. So, I mean, can you just see the mindset of the early Christians at that time? What's going on in our world? Okay? The world is corrupt. We have no power. We have no say. What's going to happen to us? Rather kind of hopeless, isn't it? Okay? And then let's look at the religious conditions here. All right? Rome was not only the center of government and wealth, it was the headquarters of religion as well. The religion of the day was a mixture of fear, superstition, and ceremony. To the Romans, the refusal to worship the emperor was a sign of disloyalty to the state and an act of treason. Emperor worship was forced upon the Christians as a test of their loyalty to the state. At first, Christians were called upon to perform the ceremonies of loyal service and worship to the emperor. The placing of a pinch of incense upon the altar, something that was just kind of, you know, a minor thing. Just do this, okay? It's all you got to do to prove your loyalty to Rome. To agree was to prove that one was not a Christian. To refuse was disloyalty. There were many who saw in this meaningless act no harm done to their Christian faith and performed it so as to escape punishment. These were practically ostracized by their fellow Christians for denying the faith. As the demand for emperor worship grew, Christians were outlawed as a body as soon as their adherence to the sect became known. So we see then, basically, Christianity in the first century, the latter part of the first century, early part of the second century, we see this developing from this, you know, it was part of the Jewish religion, kind of a break off of that, not a big problem, not a big bother, to where it became a huge problem where Christians were targeted and looked at as being, you know, hey, we got to get rid of these folks. because they are causing problems for the empire. They refuse to worship the emperor. They refuse to serve in the army. They're causing all kinds of problems in our markets because of, you know, the disrupting the idol worship and the making of idols and all those kind of things. These are problem people. Besides that, they're eating people. You know? So these folks have got to go.
Beginning for social persecution, physical persecution.
Oh, absolutely.
Just with making the turn.
Absolutely.
Just being ridiculed,
publicly,
but to
Christian
and
fight
for that.
Absolutely. You see the progression, and it began really amongst who? The Jews, okay? And there was this, wait a minute, you know, this is wrong. You know, okay, look, we crucified this Jesus who came. We thought we put an end to this Christianity stuff. But now, look at what's happening. We got to stop this thing. Then there was this fellow by the name of Saul of Tarsus. You remember him? Okay. And he was actually seeking out Christians to have them put in prison and so forth. So amongst the Jews, it was really quickly a physical persecution. But again, the Romans at that time, you know, as long as you're not causing problems for us, you know, we'll leave you alone. That's something that was between the Jews and the Christians. But when, as Christianity kept spreading, and it became more and more, there were problems that were coming up because of all these different things we just talked about, it becomes now a problem for Rome. Okay, and what does Rome do with its problems? It kills them. Okay, it just eliminates them. That's what they do. Okay, if you want to get along with us, then fine. You get along with us, you know, we'll live and let live. But if you cause problems for us, then we will eliminate you. That was their attitude and their approach. So yeah, it went from that. And of course, we know the scriptures tell us that, that the believers were first called Christians at Antioch, right? And you know, basically what I understand scholars tell us about that is that originally, when they were first called Christians, it was more of a derogatory term than it was a compliment. Okay? In other words, it was one of those, oh, you're one of those Christ followers, a Christian, huh? That kind of a name, okay? But it stuck, okay? So yeah, we see this development going. So, okay, take that, all that information, and plug it into, John writes this letter to the church that is experiencing all of this stuff. That's what's going on in their world at the time, right? How much do you suppose they needed that message that said, what does it say? Things are bad. We recognize that. They're going to get worse, though. Okay? But you can be assured of victory in the end. They needed to hear that message. People were being crucified. They were being thrown to the lions. There are stories from Nero's time where Nero had them rolled in tar and put on the streets and lit to use as streetlights. You can, I mean, there's all kinds of horrors as to the way that Christians were killed simply because they were Christians. Denise?
One of the big differences in Christianity and their pagan idol worship, too, is that there was no separation of church and state, but religion can cause a problem in the Roman Empire because it was about the rituals. As long as you did, you had your little shrine in the house, and as long as you did all those things, that's all they cared. It was strictly for show. And the problem is the Christians now brought in doctrine and dogma and belief, and so when you have that, that affects people's behavior. And the other didn't really do anything. And it's probably why some people felt like, oh, I can just go put the incense on.
Yeah.
Because it's just about the ritual anyway.
Right. And you're right, because, you know, when you start talking about things that are going to change people's lives and affect the way they're actually living, look, you can't go and worship these idols. That's wrong. Okay? You've got to stop doing this. Oh, wait a minute here. Who are you?
And so that's just one step from, oh, maybe I don't need to pay those taxes, or maybe I don't need to do it to obey what they say, or whatever. Because they had no separation of church and state. That was just all.
Well, again, because religion was just kind of wide open for those cultures. It was, you know, again, live and let live. That's what you believe, you do it, just leave everybody else alone kind of thing. When Christians come in, they start challenging people's religion and their practices and say, hey, there's only one true God, and this is what you have to do. That didn't set well. Okay? Now, so let's look at, as we finish up here, the purpose of Revelation, then, in light of this background that we just talked about. Okay? All these different things that are going on in their culture. Okay? First of all, to show that so great a power as Rome was doomed to be overthrown. That in the end, the kingdom of God would triumph and Christ would reign supreme. In other words, look, understand something. Rome is an earthly, worldly government. It's not going to last forever. Okay? So you understand as you go through and you look at some of the prophecies that had directly to do with it, Rome wasn't going to last forever. It was the power right now, but you know, it's going to fall eventually. They wanted to hear that, and they needed to hear that. It is to present a ringing call to maintain loyalty to the faith at all costs, even in the face of martyrdom. As bad as things are, and as bad as they're going to get, you need to remain faithful. Do not lose heart. Okay? They needed to hear that message. All right? You're getting ready to get thrown into the lion's den or get into the gladiator arena, and you know you're not coming out of there in any good way. Okay? You need to be reassured. All right? The message, then, is vastly relevant to us today. The call to choose the eternal rather than the temporal. Okay? Things are bad, they're going to get worse. But you know what? In the end, the victory is assured to me. As long as I don't give up. Alright? There's a call for us, just like them, to resist the temptation to give in. Okay? To refuse to compromise with pagan secularism. We have that problem going on today? Absolutely. To place the claim of conscience above all demands against it. Okay? One day, every single one of us is going to stand before the throne of God and have to give an account for our lives. Okay? In the face of all the opposition that they faced at that time and then have faced throughout history and that we face today, and you've heard me say this before, again, we're in a time where things are bad socially and, you know, and so forth, and culturally here in America, things are bad. They're going to get worse. Okay? They're going to get worse. But the message is still the same. Victory is assured in the end. Okay? And we have got to keep ourselves above all the demands that the world places against us to give in and to compromise and to go along with the world and so forth. Alright? And then finally, to cherish the confidence of ultimate victory for the kingdom of God, not only in the reign of Domitian, but also in every other chaotic period of world history, including the 21st century. Right? We need to keep that in mind. God, no matter how bad the world gets, God is and always will be in control. Okay? And that is the primary message of Revelation. So as we go through the text, keep all these kinds of things in mind as we've been talking about. And as we talk about and we look at the different things that it's saying, we're going to come away with a much clearer picture of what God wants us to know about it than if we just kind of ignore all of this information. The message of Revelation is just as relevant for you and I today as it was when it was written back at the end of the first century. Okay? What we need to do is not look at it and trying to pick apart all the different events and try to say, yeah, this applies here, this applies here, but to look at it overall and to say, what's the message that God wants you and I to have today that he wanted them to have back then? All right? Okay, that's all of our introductory stuff. Next week we'll start looking at the text. All right? Thank you all very much.
One more.